we have what I think you could say is consensus that an Everettian description of quantum cosmology, if it truly were to work, would include all sorts of anomalous histories for humans and indeed other life forms. And we need, we seem to need to want some sort of explanation as to why we don't find ourselves to have anything particularly anomalous about our evolutionary history or our experimental history. Everettians are going to have to give some sort of story about mod psi squared and say something, it may not use the word probability, but something that takes the place of a standard account of probability and allows us to construct arguments about why we're likely to experience or should behave as though we experience or something along those lines. Typical rather than anomalous events, if they're going to have any hope of making progress. Let's be alert. Sorry, when I say it's difficult language. Typical, according to Copenhagen quantum mechanics, is what I mean by typical. Why is it that the world looks like a Copenhagen world to us? Why is it that our evolutionary history seems to be explicable in terms of Copenhagen quantum mechanics? If Copenhagen quantum mechanics is not right, but the Everettian account is right, and if there are lots of creatures out there whose evolutionary histories is not explicable in terms of Copenhagen, whose experimental data is not consistent with
Copenhagen.
They might. Some of them will be, poor things. some of them will feel they have compelling evidence for some different theory because it's been anomalous in a consistent way. And so.
Yeah, but this technicality problems, I suppose in this kind of theory it's not there because everything we observe would be environmental. In the next branch to us now, so it's always that these little creatures tunnel through walls, okay, so that's an environmental thing in the giant wave function of the universe. So I don't suppose, so this wouldn't bother me about this. Of course, the question arises, is this scientific and that does it make a difference? Yeah. So, but now, to us, we always observe, the Copenhagen stuff, and we observe probability distributions, but this is only because we happen to be in some particular branch of the big function, or do I get something wrong here?
No? Well, you get something, certainly that's right, if the Everettian account is right. Not all the branches that contain humans who think they've understood quantum mechanics. So the question is, why are we in that branch? Let me just finish this transparency and then go back to a quote from Everett.
You can apply anthropic reasoning. Yes. So
you could try. Is it going to work? Yes.
I suppose. In this kind of theory, I suppose it works.
Why? Well, it would be interesting to flesh that out. So I'm going to try and flesh both sides of that argument out. Let's be alert to a possibility. Everettians, on the whole, tend to be particularly clever people. They're certainly not going to fail to discuss this problem entirely. They're certainly going to offer some sort of account of something like probability. But let's be alert to the possibility, at least, that they might offer a kind of probability that sort of addresses other issues, that maybe even resolves some other interesting questions about how it is that we end up using something like a standard classical probability theory in the world, but fails to address this one. I highlight this because I have to confess I suspect it's actually the case. And I've even written a confession here. If there is any Everettian account of probability that's succeeding in answering this question, then this may be correlated with the evidence of Everettians, but then it's one that I've so far failed to understand. I'm deeply puzzled on this point.
I don't understand your confession. Can you say it in different words? What are you let's say the Wallace program for deriving the normal has succeeded. Still doesn't address this issue? Is that what you're
For instance, yes. Papers by Wallace, Deutsch, and others on Everett and probability. If they contain some answer to this question, it's what I don't understand why it's an answer. I'm missing something.
Oh, so is it simply because if the tails are still there, then there will still be the outlier worlds, regardless of whether one makes the board room or not?
I'm going to say more about this, and can we let me postpone answering that and think about it? Yeah.
Sir, I'm not quite sure what you mean when you say that we seem to be species that have evolved without relying on deviations from Copenhagen quantum mechanics. Because that to me seems that we evolved according to Copenhagen quantum mechanics, and so we've got the data that tells us that we've evolved according to Copenhagen quantum mechanics. I'm not quite sure what that means.
What?
I mean, why would we have to have had deviations from Copenhagen?
No, we don't. I think I agree with you, so let me try and express this more clearly. As far as we understand it, to explain our evolution history, there are lots of gaps that we haven't really got to account of all the steps of the origin of. But we've got no real reason to think that we can't all be done on the basis of Copenhagen quantum mechanics. Now, that isn't true of all the creatures in all the branches of the Everettian universe. It is true by any means. Lots of them will be anomalous worlds in which they were able to evolve only because those worlds were anomalous. Those worlds deviated from quantum mechanics, one way or another. So the question is why are we in Copenhagen? Why do we find ourselves in a Copenhagen respecting world as far as our evolutionary history, our experimental history? Is concerned, given the theory says there are all sorts of things that happen, almost anything can happen and does happen to some creatures out there.
Right, so now this basically focuses directly on us and what we see, as in why we in particular evolved according to, well, as far as we see it,
what sort of story can.
Why are we sort of privileged in the sense that we've, obviously privileged in the comments that we. Evolved according to the Copenhagen view, whereas others might have evolved according to the
universes view. Yeah, they might not have got as far as understanding many universes, but they might have evolved according to some version of quantum mechanics that doesn't use a Born rule, but something different. So there are all sorts of stuff out there. Why are we in a branch that has this sort of regularity, this predictability and statistics that Copenhagen gives us? Let's focus just a little further on that. What if there isn't an answer to that in Everett's theory? That doesn't mean the theory is wrong in the sense that it's logically refuted. The theory just says there is a universe, or Everettians tend to call it a multiverse, that's teeming with creatures, all sorts of different creatures. But among them certainly are creatures whose worlds are described in quantum mechanics. Well, our world is described as Copenhagen. So we're in there. Our existence is apparently consistent with the Everettian account. The problem isn't one of consistency, though. The problem is that it just isn't. If that's all one can say, pretty much anything could have happened, and we just happen to be one example of something that could have happened. It isn't a very good scientific theory. If that's the limit of it, pretty much anything, including Copenhagen mechanics, could be right. He published a paper saying that. I'm not sure your colleagues would think so highly of your understanding of what science was all about. And let's go back to one of the claims I quoted earlier from Everett. Everett claimed to do more, and he thought it was important that one could do more. His claim was to supply a formulation from which the conventional interpretation, Copenhagen interpretation, can be deduced. So if there isn't an answer to this key question, then Everett's claim is wrong. If we can't explain our experience, if we can't explain our experience of Copenhagen quantum mechanics from an Everettian perspective, then this ambitious and interesting thing. Okay, which is why I think it really is a key question, and one worth focusing on if one wants to pursue their writing ideas and to try and understand what everything's thinking. Let's move on though. Let's talk about another issue. What about this notion of personal identity that we tend to cherish? I shouldn't maybe take the graph. But generally, we tend to think of ourselves as sort of objects with a stable identity over time, i.e., I'm the same person just at a later time as the person who ate breakfast this morning and had dinner last night and so on. Everett seems to give us grounds to, rather radical grounds to question that. Is that itself a problem for Everett? I don't think so. Physical theories can have unsettling consequences. Quantum mechanics itself does. Special relativity does. They can radically alter our worldview. I don't think, in general, we should reject them just because we're unsettled, and I don't think we should reject Everett simply because it's unsettling on this particular point. Whatever it says is, after you do a quantum experiment, or after some sort of cosmic ray that creates some sort of quantum event that amplifies macroscopic hits you, or hits something in the environment near you that you can see, you do not have a unique successor. Here is you now, before. Here are two different successors which have the same memories, these little dots, up to this point, but a different memory, the result of the experiment. Okay, you don't have a unique successor. I think we just have to accept that and see what consequences it has, rather than quailing at this point and rejecting it. A natural question, one that people often raise is, well, if that's the case, you know, what's the point of my life? Why am I carrying out actions? Why do I care about these multiple successes? I don't find that persuasive either. you should rethink perhaps your perspective on a one world view. Why if you believe in a single world, in a single successor, if you believe in only one successor, why do you care about him or her? And if you could find good enough reasons to care about your future selves in a one world, why would you not? Why do those reasons not apply when you have two or more successes in future world? What sensible reasons could you possibly advance for not caring about multiple successes that wouldn't also apply in a single universe? Yeah?
Why can I not simply write the state before
us,
1 half U plus 1 half V, so that I have the same
What's that?
I can just split myself in two worlds there already, and one of them goes into zero, and the other into one.
You want to change them?
In any way that the theory prescribes?
Why not? You can write any wave function just as, well, wave function is just a superposition. You can just as well make a superposition of two identical parts. It's just writing one as 1 half plus 1 half.
You wouldn't say you have You want to believe that you are, although it's not clear to you which, you are already the person who's going to experience either zero or one.
There are going to be many worlds anyway. Why are they not already here? Why do I need to break at some point?
Well, there are going to, can we agree on this? There are going to be copies of you in the future that share every property, every memory of you up to now,
sure.
But with distinct memories of the experiment. Why? Is there some tangible reason for claiming ownership for one of them and not the other, or preferring one of them and not the other? Can you pick out some sort of perspective that says, look, I really don't care what happens to one guy? He can
the same way you did it before. You just look at plus infinity and you work your way backwards.
But you haven't. Can you now identify any of them? Okay, well, that's I grant you, that is a possible perspective on Everett. On Everett. Something like, you can set up a story something like this, that there are many copies of your mind that follow definite trajectories through the branches, and they're different trajectories. There always were many, many selves, and those selves gradually sort of diverge across the branches. I don't find that attractive personally, but that's a matter of taste. It seems to be proliferating the ontology even further. David, and there's a famous sort of accusation of David Deutsch against Bohmians that they're Everettians in denial. I think this is, that sort of Everettian is really a Bohmian in denial.
Well, that's exactly what this is. It's a hidden variable that goes through and identifies one of these people as really evil, one who's not really evil.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a possible perspective. Okay, so if, as I claim, you should care about your Everettian successors, how are you going to treat them? So let's accept for the moment you have non-unique successors. Let's accept that you agree that you should care about their welfare. It would be good. I mean, you've got to do something. You know, you've got to live your life. You've got to decide in every instant how you're going to behave, knowing that it's going to affect your successors, and sometimes it's going to affect different successors differently. So it would be good if we could establish some sort of rational calculus for decisions affecting their welfare. David Deutsch, and with ideas that have been later elaborated further by David Wallace, among others, but those two in particular, have tried to establish and to justify precisely such a calculus. I'm not going to go through the whole argument here. So again, I apologize, I can only really refer you to the papers and then to interesting criticisms of those papers by, among others, Chris Brooks and co-authors. But very, very roughly, the idea starts like this. You appeal to some sort of claim of symmetry to say, if we have an equally weighted mixture of different successors, here's a successor who's seen zero, here's the state zero, here's the corresponding environment, let's call it E0, here's one who's seen one, different environment, let's say orthogonal, here's one who's seen outcome two, there were three possible outcomes in the experiment, different environment again. If they're equally weighted, a symmetry argument together with a claim that you should care only about, you shouldn't care about the environmental stuff, it's irrelevant, you shouldn't care about this thing, they're all interchangeable, and you could apply a unitary map anyway to map them around, suggests the axiom that you should care equally about these three equally weighted successors, and more generally, you should care equally about any equally weighted successors when there's a situation where you want to normalize. What do you do about non-equally weighted successors? What would you do if there's a 1 over root 3 here, and a 2 over root 3, a root 2 over 3 rather here, and this thing wasn't there? Well, that's dealt with in this line of reasoning by considering the possibility of further splittings that could produce equally weighted outcomes. And there's, it's a different line of argument, but there's some sort of formal analogy here with the arguments of Wojciech-Zurek. Deriving the Born rule. So one tries to reduce the non-equally weighted case to the equally weighted case and to appeal to, in the end, arguments based on symmetry in the equally weighted case. And the conclusion that is claimed to emerge is that mod psi squared emerges as a unique, rational thing that you might call a carrying weight. People do need to call a carrying weight for your successors. What's a carrying weight? A carrying weight is, I mean, very roughly speaking, a positive real number that says how much you care about the welfare of any particular successor. So what does it mean to say you're carrying weight for some particular successor? Let's call him or her capital X, is P. Well, it means, firstly, that your carrying weights for all the other successors are going to sum up to 1 minus P. Fine. Secondly, if you're faced with a situation in which you... let me finish this first. You're faced with a situation in which you could somehow distribute money among the successors. And this distribution is going to include both positive and negative signs. You're going to agree to it. You're going to be happy to give A dollars to successor X and take away B dollars from all the other successors, if and only if the carrying weight P times A minus carrying weight 1 minus P times B is positive. Another way of putting that is this. Suppose you're doing an experiment quantum experiment, and there's a list of possible outcomes, and here's one possible outcome, let's call it little x, and x, capital X, the successor of yours, is the one who saw outcome x, and the other successors are the ones who saw different outcomes. That's y, that's z, and so on. When you're willing to enter into a contract which says, if I saw outcome X, somebody will give me P dollars. I'm sorry, somebody will give me A dollars. And if I don't see outcome X, so that's all the rest of these, I will lose B dollars. You're willing to do that as long as that equation holds. A times P minus B times 1 minus P is greater than or equal to 0. In other words, in the sort of classical way of thinking about things, you're willing to place a bet at odds on the outcome of the experiment, provided those odds are 1 minus P to P or better. So the classical idea of accepting odds on a probabilistic outcome of an experiment translates in this Everettian picture into distributing money among successors. But the Everettian analysis, we can translate the Everettian analysis back into classical language. And that, according to the Sunday argument, is one of the teachings. I think there are quite a few questions. Okay. Let's start with this end.
How did you get the carrying weight
again? I sketched very, very, very quickly. But the idea was, for equal weighted successors, you use symmetry to say that you should care about them equally.
But that's a step. How does that follow? The weighting you have in your expansion has got something to do with what you care about your successor. That's where the sort of slide is.
Well, in the. That's the wrong way of putting it. These are not supposed to be sort of logical proofs, they're supposed to be arguments that are rational, arguments that a reasonable person who believes in Everettian quantum mechanics would find reasonable. So you've got to start from somewhere. You've got to set up some axioms in order to drive anything. And the argument starts from there. If you have a symmetric situation with equal weights and you care about them equally, why wouldn't you give them symmetry? You don't have to buy that. No, certainly logically you don't have to buy that. But that's where it starts from. And then it goes on to try and reduce the unequally weighted case to the equally weighted case. I'm once again, perhaps, following a strategy of sort of giving as much ground as one can in order to see whether even if you give all that ground, you still run into problems. So I agree you don't have to buy this, but for the moment, I'm going to take that one. Yep.
Clearly, this is an argument from a meta perspective, but I have to know about all the other possible successes of some of these things. I don't see any way, even in principle, how I could know about them.
What you do now can only affect, so to speak, successes of yours. Sure, there are lots of other branches that diverged earlier, but there's nothing you can do now that's going to get influenced then.
It's not actually. I am here, and I only see one branch, but here, taking that perspective, and arguing about all the branches from here on, I agree with the
branches from here on. Yep.
So I have to know them somehow to justify that argument.
Yeah.
I don't see any way how I can, in principle, could know them.
Well, can we agree at least in sort of particular cases you will know? If you're going to go into a lab and do a quantum experiment and you're measuring the spin and you know there are two possible outcomes, then you know that experiment is going to produce two different successes.
Okay, so as long as extremely large equivalence classes and branches and only equivalence classes would be one to outcomes of one specific experiment.
So then maybe we can at least say something about what sort of wages you're willing to take on the outcomes of quantum experiments if you buy them. Yeah. Yep.
When can you say that in the present you're worrying about sort of versions of yourself in the future?
Yep.
I mean, that seems to me a slightly unnecessary complication. For example, suppose that you work with two jobs,
yep.
And you had to choose between the jobs on the basis of what was written in two different envelopes, or three different envelopes, whatever, and it was the best of two. And two of the envelopes said you're going to work in Zurich, and one of them said you're going to work in London. And so you'd say, okay, fair enough, then there are greater odds for them to work in Munich, and you say, okay, there are greater odds for them to work in Zurich than in London, so I'll buy a villa in Zurich, and I'll just buy an apartment in London. If you wanted to sort of make provisions for your future self. And then if you found Zurich, then you say, okay, fair enough, I'll sell the apartment in London, and it's fine, I've got my living in Zurich. But isn't that completely unnecessary? Wouldn't it make a lot more sense to just let the future happen and then decide what to do rather than make provisions for it?
Yeah, in that sense it works, yeah, sure. I mean, if you're going to let a quantum experiment, for instance, decide whether you're going to work in Zurich or London, you're better off waiting till after the outcome before you buy your villa rather than buying the villa first and then possibly having to sell it again. But suppose you're faced with a situation in which somebody is asking you to place bets on the outcome of a quantum experiment. Well, now you can't. And they'll say, all right, I'll give you $100 if it's spin up, but it will cost you $1 if it's spin down, or something like that. Well, you can't. I mean, you could accept the bet or you could reject the bet, but you can't say, well, look, I'll tell you what, let's wait till after the experiment, and then I'll tell you whether or not I want to accept or reject the bet. They're not going to be interested in that, because it's just not part of the rules of the game. So you should, in this situation, you're forced to consider the fate of both successes in the experiment and to somehow balance one against the other in deciding whether or not this is a good or a bad bet to accept.
That just says you shouldn't play Russian roulette in front of your cat. If you care about your own well-being, this is not physics.
No,
but I mean, isn't that a kind of rephrasing of, of the actual, what, the formula in a certain sense that says that
Well, it's supposed to. That's sort of the game that's being played here. One's supposed to recover something that at least in some context resembles the Born rule or gives the same prescription as the Born rule would from an Everettian analysis rather than from a one world.
So basically, analysis. If your Born rule is saying you've got your wave function, whatever you can decide, probably use certain outcomes according to the coefficients, whereas the Everettian point of view has a slightly more anthropocentric view of the thing and says that you decide on the basis of making provisions for your future self.
So yeah. We agreed already, I think, that Everettians are going to have to say something that looks a bit like the standard theory of probability, and also that they can't say the same thing as the standard classical probabilist will say. They can't. Classical probabilist will say, well, look, something, either this will happen or that will happen, and probability says something about the likelihood or the propensity or something like that. Everettians certainly can't say that because their theory says both of these things will happen. So the idea of these arguments is nonetheless to recover at least some features of a classical probabilistic analysis from an Everettian perspective, and so to try and claw back the ground that we thought Everettians might have lost in their inability to talk about probabilistic statements. Yeah, one more.
Say you knew that one of your successes was going to be a lot more successful than the others. Say you solved whatever problem. Wouldn't you want to push the probability of that happening to one by killing yourself in all other worlds?
I'm not sure I would, but what's the option that's being offered here exactly?
I think you change the probability by whether you kill yourself.
Yeah, I did understand.
You want the probability that you become that successor.
Dying is an option.
Dying happens. It's not like you're removing that possibility.
Yeah, you're not removing that possibility from the space-time continuum. You're just dying.
Probably slowly and painfully.
Don't you care about that person that's
going to
die?
Okay.
Please.
That's really cool. Okay, I think there are problems with these arguments and there are problems with the way these arguments are applied. I want to, when should I finish this?
So 10 past 12.
Okay. I want to give a sort of hypothetical example that I think illustrates one of the difficulties with this whole program. And not for the first time. It touches on objections people have already suggested in questions. Okay, so you're a gifted and technologically powerful person who has a divine, and you're able to create little universes, and you're able to destroy little universes. This is your universe creator, this is your universe destroyer. They don't have to be sort of universes on our scale, they can be computer simulations, but we're going to assume that these things are capable of, within the simulation, of running, of creating conscious creatures. So here they are. Here's one of the universes you created. Here are some of the creatures within it. And you set things up so that they can work out many of the laws of physics in their universe. And you've also set things up so that there's a particular type of experiment they can do, which won't have a predictable outcome. So here's a special type of experimental device. And you tell them, okay, if you do an experiment of this particular type, what I'm going to do is take your universe, put it in the universe crusher, and destroy you. But I'm going to create some number of copies. I'm not going to tell you how many, but I'm going to create some number of copies of that universe together with the with different possible outcomes, and there may be lots of copies with the same outcome. So here's outcome zero instantiated in this one and this one. Here's outcome one instantiated in this one. And so on. Oh, and by the way, in these universes, in all of them, there's a little number written in the sky. So here's a number written in the sky here. And you're sort of sitting outside here, but you're pretty much playing the sort of role of God here. So you're able to talk to the creatures inside here and explain to them any of the rules they haven't been able to work out. And you talk to them about the numbers in the sky. You say, well, look, it just pleases me to write these numbers in your sky and in your universe. And what I'm going to do whenever you do one of these experiments is I'm going to make, well, there's some sort of rule for the two outcomes. Let's say that the zero outcome and the one outcome are going to be treated as symmetric. I'm going to make sure that the sum of the outcomes corresponding to zero, some of the numbers in the sky, adds up to half of the original number. So here's one way of doing that. Yeah, 0.025, 0.025, 0.05. So if you do the experiment, zero, one possible outcomes, one possible thing I could do is make two, after it crushed you, make two copies of the universe with outcome zero, and I'll write the number 0.025 in the sky for each of those, and one copy with outcome one, and I'll write 0.05 in the sky with that one. And another thing I could do is make 14 copies of zero, and take all their numbers to be positive and add up to 0.05, and 28 copies of one with numbers that add up to 0.05. I'm not going to tell you which, but I do promise, and you're going to believe me, that I'll follow these rules. Okay, so the add up to original number.
What's the original number?
It's the one written in your style. It's 0.1 here.
So I'm lost already. So there's one universe. I'm in that universe.
Yep.
And then so you're standing outside. You're making more universes.
If you press the button of the experimental device, yeah.
Who am I? Am I the guy inside or am I the guy outside?
You're the guy inside.
Okay, so if you press the button on your experimental device.
No, you.
Me. Oh, yeah. The little one. Okay, so if I press the button, then I get either a zero or a one.
Well, no, you get crushed. But
I get crushed and Okay, so I press the button on the experiment and I get crushed.
You get crushed, but then I create multiple copies. Identical in every aspect, except that some of them have zero outcomes and some of them have one outcomes.
Right.
And the other thing is that they have different numbers in the sky, but the numbers satisfy this rule. The numbers in the sky for zero add up to original number over two.
But what are you talking about?
In your stuff, yeah.
So I'm crushing myself and you're making more such that they all add up to what you put in mind,
yeah.
But they have crushed.
Yeah.
Conspiracy between you and God?
Hmm?
Me and you, like, is there any conspiracy between you and I?
Well, not if I'm getting crushed.
There's communication. There's communication enough that you, the people living in the universe, understand these rules. And you might say, well, I don't want to get crushed, but I'm going to do these experiments. But you have to, time to time, I'm sorry. Okay. So you're in a situation where it's sort of obvious where we're going with this, I think. From time to time, you know you're going to get crushed, and successors of you are going to be created, and they're going to be successors who see one of the defined number of experimental outcomes, and by the way, they're going to have numbers written in their sky. And you ask me, well, why do you write the numbers in the sky? And I say, well, just a job. It just seems like a fun thing to do to me. But I promise I'll always obey these rules, and you believe me. So then you have a problem. You've got to make decisions about what you'll do, what sort of bets you'll accept on the outcome of experiments that will affect the welfare of your successors. And you can run through an analysis exactly parallel to the Everettian's analysis and say, well, if I know, suppose I know, for instance, that the outcome after this experiment is of this form. Well, there's perfect symmetry here. I'm indifferent to the outcomes themselves. I care about the successors and their dogs. There's symmetry between the numbers in the sky. So I have equal care and weight. In this case. And with a little more thought and ingenuity, you could be persuaded, well, at least one possible rational algorithm that fits this and that will work in general is to say that I care about a successor in proportion to the number that's written in their sky. And with further thought, you... This thing. Now let's see.
Don't wipe the board for ideas, it's fresh.
So actually, given the way things are set up, given that you don't know how many copies are going to be made of any different type of successor, the only algorithm that will work in that you can define in general that respects symmetries of outcomes. Experiments, for instance, is to care about successors in proportion to the number written in the sky. So if you run through the analog of the Everettian decision theoretic analysis, you're more or less forced to the conclusion that the only rational strategy available to you is this one. You're going to care about your successors. Yes, how much do you care? Depends on the number written in the sky. Don't know what the number is. Never mind, I can take bets using this because I know what the sum of the numbers will be for every given outcome, and that's enough. Does that mean that we've recovered a sensible strategy? Does it mean we've recovered something that's intelligible in terms of standard probability? Well, I rather resist that conclusion because the fact of the matter is these numbers are just numbers written in the sky. They may be the only things you can use for rational strategy, but that doesn't for well-defined strategy. But that doesn't make them a rational way of treating the welfare of successors. There seems no And what's true of numbers in the sky seems to me equally true of amplitudes in an Everettian wave function or mod squared of amplitudes. Even if one accepts the axioms one starts from and the conclusion of the argument that the only well-defined strategy we can deduce is one that uses mod psi squared, that doesn't make it a sensible strategy, doesn't make it a rational strategy. It doesn't mean we really have any reason to follow it. We could if we want to, but...
I thought you just said it was. The only well-defined, generally, of the most looking strategy with respect to symmetry.
It well-defined, but why follow it? That's the question. So that's what I'm trying to get at, I guess. Is it enough for something to be the only well-defined strategy to make it... To make it actually rational to follow it. Is that a compelling reason to follow it?
With respect to symmetry, right? I mean, you can't...
One more?
I'm confused. That's all right.
Can I just see if I can clarify the larger direction of your argument? You're saying that some proponents of an Everettian multiverse view have come up with these complicated arguments about why, if we did live in an Everettian multiverse, we would still behave as if we expected probability to work the way it does in a more conventional interpretation of quantum mechanics.
At least when, as regards accepting wagers on the
other hand. At least as regards accepting wagers. Mm-hmm. And so you presented these arguments, and then your contention is that those arguments aren't compelling, and that it still wouldn't be the only rational way, and you're not convinced. Is that correct?
It could. The argument is, even if one accepts it's the only well-defined strategy, that isn't a compelling reason for adopting it. It doesn't even make it a necessarily rational strategy.
So your contention is that at least these Everettians don't haven't convinced you or haven't put forward a convincing argument to why their kind of view of the multiverse gives rise to a more conventional view of probability?
There seems still to be something missing.
Okay.
There seems to be a gap between the conclusion of the argument and what you want to establish some reason for justifying it.
Okay.
Yeah.
This seems irrelevant and not unnecessary to me, attempt to use symmetries to derive why the Karen weights are related to the square of the probability amplitudes.
Okay, so how would you do it?
Shouldn't it just be part of the theory that you should care about branches in proportion to the square of, or should care about kets in proportion to the square of the number sitting in front of it, why should the square of that?
It should be part of your... We have a fundamental physical axiom that talks about caring and how much you should care about
No more successes. Than in classical mechanics, for example, you presumably take it as a fundamental part of classical mechanics that you should care about the world that is actual. Amongst all possible worlds, you should care about the world that is actual, not the possible. You know, the possible solutions to Newtonian mechanics, classical Newtonian mechanics, in which the world is at 400,000 miles from the sun. You shouldn't care about those. You should only care about the world that is actual. And it seems you can do an exactly parallel construction here and just declare that you should only care about those worlds that have a probability amplitude, and you should care about them in proportion to the square modulus of their probability amplitude.
Do you believe that, or are you sort of pressing it?
I believe it.
You believe it, okay. So, what can I say about that? It doesn't seem to me that analogy is right. So in the possible world's case, your ontology is reality. There is just this actual world in reality. One doesn't seem to need any further argument to say we care about what happens in reality, not about stuff that could have happened but
didn't. Well, it seems that you're using the word exists tricep question.
Well, I thought it was... How so?
So, why should I care about the... In classical mechanics, why should I care about the actual world rather than all the possible worlds? And you're saying, well, one of them, only one of them really exists, and that sort of underwrites my claim that I should care about it rather than the others. Well, then you can do an exactly parallel construction in quantum mechanics. Any construction you do there, you can do a parallel construction in quantum mechanics. And the parallel construction is going to be only those bits of the possible space of the wave function that actually have a probability amplitude exist, and they exist in proportion to the square modulus of that of the number sitting in front of the head.
They exist in proportion. Can you explain what it means to sort of exist in proportion to R, for example?
I can give an operational definition in terms of the results of experiments.
These guys are not operational.
But it sounded like an ontological statement.
Oh, it is an ontological
statement. Okay, so... It's an interesting line of thought. I just don't seem to be able to make this translation from possible worlds versus actual to many worlds in the smooth way that you want to do it. And I know you're not alone in this. I think there are other people from the Oxford School who would ask you similar things. I'm not sure if I can say anything more helpful right at this point, so then we could continue the discussion afterwards. So I hear what you're saying. Let's take that on board as another way of thinking about these things. One more question?
May I make a 15-second comment on that?
Yeah.
The statement, if the amplitude is 1 and all the others are 0, then we should care entirely about the one with amplitude 1, is clearly implied by the square carrying weights, right? But it's not at all obvious that it in turn implies the essentially Born's rule. So it's very interesting to ask, if we start from simply what appears to be a weaker assumption, which is we should care about the real world, can we then get to this assumption that appears to be much stronger, which is we should care in proportion to square? It's much in parallel to what Wojciech did the other day.
Okay, go ahead.
45.
Let's leave that there. Let me carry on. I'm actually almost at the end of this bit of discussion. Well, the second thing I would say is that despite the ingenious to argue it to be the case, I am not persuaded that monster-sized square actually does emerge as a unique, rational, carrying weight within Everettian quantum theory. Why am I not persuaded? In the end, for a rather simple reason. It's one that the people who argue for this go to some ingenious lengths to avoid, but I'm not sure if works. Here, let's consider a whole series of binary experiments. Here's your successor with, you've seen the outcome 0, 0, 0, 0, this one's seen 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Zero, one, zero, 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 and so on. A complete list of possible outcomes. Now, the fact of the matter is, in some sort of realistic analysis of branchings, we're not going to have a one branch, one successor rule. This is something that David Morris, in particular, cogently argues. There'll be lots of other quantum events going on, and so there are many branches that contain successes of this type. There are many branches that contain successes of this type, etc., etc., etc. How many? Again, the fact of the matter is that, not just practically, but even in principle, that's not really an answerable question. It sort of depends how you look at things. It goes back to this question of whether there's a unique way to decompose the universal wave function to a sort of quasi-classical world. Well, no, there isn't. You could write it like this, you could write it like this, with a slightly different but pretty much as good definition of quasi-classicality, and so on. So the number of branches is undefined. In other words, there's no ontological fact of the matter that says this one is in a million branches and this one is in 3 million and so on. So you cannot do what critics of Everett often suggest you might want to do, which is to just to count the number of branches and say, well, I'm going to care about each successor in each branch equally. So if there are a million branches here, I have a caring of a million for this successor. 2 million here, this one gets 2 million, and so on. That would be something different from the Born rule if it worked, but these numbers are not defined, so it doesn't work. What I'm not persuaded by is that there's a compelling sense in which it's irrational to say, never mind, I don't want to count by branches. I want to label successors by memory states, and I'm simply going to say I value successors with all the different possible memory states of sequences of experiments equally. So I care about him. The totality of representatives of that memory state equally to the totality of representatives of that memory state. And so, yeah, we've done a sequence of binary experiments, and we're worrying about our successors in our different memories of the outcomes of the binary outcomes of this sequence. Okay, so assuming that these were non-experiments with equal probabilities of 0 and 1, assuming the weights are unequal, this prescription is certainly different from the Born rule. I don't understand in what sense it could be said to be irrational or ill-defined. So I offer this as an alternative. And that's certainly a problem for anybody who wants to claim that there's a unique rational strategy. Third thing, even if we reject that, and even if we reject this, and even if we accept the analysis, what we seem to have derived is a rule that tells us why it's rational on the face of it to wager according to the Born rule probabilities in an Everettian universe, given that we believe we actually are in an Everettian universe. And on the face of this says nothing about the question I suggested earlier, the key question, why are we among those universe dwellers who ever found themselves in a position to infer from their experiments given in quantum mechanics, and hence later, after some more thought about the structure of quantum mechanics, Everett quantum mechanics. Why did we ever get to the starting, find ourselves in the position of getting to the starting point? It seems to me that still remains unanswered, and this program doesn't have the power, doesn't have the strength to address them. Any more questions? Have I? Yeah.
In part three here?
Yep.
Maybe I'm wrong here, but it seems like we're talking about probability here, essentially, right? And it seems as if we're mixing two different conceptions.
Uh-huh.
Even that, when we talk about it's rational to wager, right, that's essentially a Bayesian view of probability. Just for a Bayesian, wagers are probability. But then below that, you say, says nothing about why we are.
Mm.
And this sounds very close to a relative frequency view. It's just said that, you know, with probability one, essentially, we end up in one of these universes.
Well, that
so in other words, if this is a statement about wagers, then wouldn't it be more consistent to say someone at the beginning of the universe would wager that their descendants would end up in a universe where they would infer Multicon quantum mechanics?
There is nobody at the beginning of the universe who has descendants that are all the creatures of the universe. What's wrong with the question as posed? Why shouldn't we ask, why are we creatures who see this sort of thing rather than that sort of thing?
Because in this program, you say this program tells us about what is rational to wager, right? So it's not saying something about what is, it's saying something about what bets should be taken. So it predicts that I should take the bet that my descendants will be in a Copenhagen compatible universe. But it doesn't say something about what they will be.
Given that you already have verified Copenhagen quantum mechanics for yourself, you should take that bet. It says something like that. But could this be a problem with the program? I mean, could it be that if the program is going to end up telling you how to make wagers on experiments, given that you already understand quantum mechanics, but no more, it isn't powerful enough to do what science actually requires and whatever it originally hoped?
Because it being rational for me to bet on a future Copenhagen depends on present Copenhagenness. I think that's a valid flaw.
Uh-huh.
But as it's phrased up there, this has gone too long.
Okay, so I'm not sure maybe we actually agree.
It's not an interesting enough question to take.
Correct. Question?
So at the very, very, very beginning of the talk, you mentioned something about gravity. Maybe if I remember correctly, you said maybe neighborhoods may have something to do with gravity.
So the idea, Everett's idea, was that if you want to make sense of something like quantum gravity, quantum theory in the context of cosmology, the Copenhagen interpretation certainly is not adequate. Because the Copenhagen interpretation requires you to use classical devices to prepare a system, and then classical devices to carry out measurements of the system. It requires you to be dealing with a system where you're able to address it from the outside. In the cosmological context, we're not standing outside the universe. We're part of the system we want to understand. We never prepared it. We might have some theory about its initial state. So one seems, and on this at least I agree with Everett, one seems to need something quite radically different from Copenhagen interpretation in order to make any sense of quantum theory in the cosmological context. And quantum gravity, if our idea is that there is a quantum theory of gravity right, then quantum gravity is going to have to be part of quantum gravity. So, of course, saying that Copenhagen doesn't work in this context doesn't mean that the next idea that comes along necessarily does well, but it gives motivation for trying Everettian and other ideas.
Are there any developments in triangle quantum gravity in Everett's approach? I mean, apart from this original statement?
It's not that this approach helps one with the difficult technical problems of quantizing gravity. It's supposed to be a way to interpret. Yeah, I mean, people have tried to sort of flesh out how you might make sense of quantum cosmology in an Everettian context, in particular Gell-Mann and Hartle. Everettian or post-Everettian, one might think about because they add further structure to it. And I think, I mean, in a sense, it seems to me almost everybody who works on quantum cosmology and who takes it seriously either is an Everettian or is just or is willing to sort of pretend they're an Everettian for the purpose of their calculations and doesn't worry too much about the details of the interpretation. You're not sure about that. Perhaps that's too strong. But at least there's a strong correlation between cosmologists and Everettians and cosmic Everettians. So. Yeah.
I have two very basic questions. So one is, could you just comment on this Hopkins race of thinking whether you think that we could throw away these other words from the race argument? And the second one is just a very basic problem to me with this. It seems that Like they start from the mathematical representation and they see these what looks like many worlds, but there's nothing in the physical reality that suggests this really. And it seems like a troublesome starting point.
Well, I think both of those are big worries. So, as you know, of course, Occam's razor, in this context, Occam's razor is famously double-edged. Everettians will say, we're trying to get rid of unnecessary laws in the original formulation of quantum mechanics, protection postulates, doesn't seem to fit naturally with unitary evolution. Why not just throw it away and simplify it? From a different perspective, the price of doing that is that one ends up with a multiple worlds picture. Now, whether that's my own view is if everything else worked, if you had an intelligible account of probability in Everett and you're persuaded by the functionalist argument, that would be a price worth paying. However, I think the problems with probability in particular are so difficult to resolve and so unlikely to be satisfactorily resolved. But the program doesn't work, and in a sense, you don't need to get into the optimal trees. That's better. That's okay. Another thing to say is if we go back to the idea of explicitly codified rules for the branching structure, then Occam's razor gains much greater force. You can say, well, why say that all these branches, which are explicitly characterized, are realized rather than just one of them is realized? It's not so obvious to me how you're going to apply it in a version of Everett in which you don't have an explicit account of branches. I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's at least less clear what that means. Lucy, how are we doing for time?
Maybe we should
stop at this point.
Thank you.